Great. Well, thanks for joining me. So I kind of wanted in this episode to talk a bit about your work, specifically your book, this great book I read a few months ago called The Man from the Future, The Visionary Life of John von Neumann. Highly recommend it to anyone watching. To talk a bit about this book, your thoughts on John von Neumann, and kind of interweave this with some questions about your own life as well. So first thing I wanted to ask was, I mean, many people regard John von Neumann as perhaps the smartest person to ever live. That's obviously not agreed upon by everyone, but yourself, if you were to kind of make that case, what would maybe be three things that you'd say, three of his achievements that make him stand out from these other kind of great figures?
Yeah, I mean, I would go along with the smartest person that we know of, certainly in the last century. Well, the first thing is the things that you're filming me on, they run on the von Neumann architecture, and that's because in 1946, von Neumann came up with the canonical architecture for all computers that you're likely to use. So before that report, most computers, in fact, all of them, couldn't be programmed. They involved sort of wires and switches, and if you wanted to run a different program, then you had to essentially rewire them like an old telephone switchboard. But because of the EDVAC report, that spawned an era of programmable computers. So practically every computer since then has been designed in the way that von Neumann set out in that report. So that's one thing. Secondly, he invented modern game theory, which is kind of the mathematics of human behavior, I suppose. It's the mathematics of games, obviously. And he did that as a hobby in between, you know, inventing the modern computer and working at Los Alamos on atom bombs, along with lots of extremely clever people. So game theory has become hugely important over the last couple of decades. And one example is that about 80% of Google's income depends on its ads. And AdWords, which is the platform that it used to use, all the auctions that take place within there run on a game theory algorithm. Okay, so you could argue that about three lines of mathematics that stem from von Neumann's work in 1920 and 1940, that's responsible for Google's profits. And the other 20% is due to the architecture that he invented as well. So, and Google's not alone in using those sorts of auctions. So Amazon and so on, huge chunks of their income come from these sorts of auctions. So that's only two. The third, I guess, would be quantum mechanics. So von Neumann turned up at Göttingen immediately after his PhD, which he'd finished when he was 21. So he turned up at Göttingen at 22, and he was at Göttingen because of David Hilbert, who was the leading mathematician of the day. He was kind of maths' spokesperson, and Göttingen was where all of mathematics was happening. It was the center of the world as far as mathematics went. So it's kind of natural that, you know, the most renowned young mathematician in the world should end up there. Now, just by coincidence, when he turns up, who should be there but another whiz kid called Werner Heisenberg. And Heisenberg's been busy. He's actually a year older than von Neumann, and he's been busy inventing this new science of atoms called, ended up being called quantum mechanics. But within a few months of von Neumann arriving in Göttingen, there's a competing version, and that's by Erwin Schrödinger from Vienna. And they look nothing like each other. And you have Heisenberg's matrices, just like rows of numbers, and that is how his quantum mechanics works. That's the maths of it. And Schrödinger's depends on waves. And there was a lot of confusion here. How can these two completely different looking mathematics, how can they both be giving, seemingly giving the right answers? And what does it say about nature deep down? You know, is it waves? Is it strange particles jumping about, or what is it? And what von Neumann did within months of arriving, within months of these two versions of quantum mechanics appearing, was he showed mathematically that they were, in a deep way, identical, mathematically identical. So those, I guess, were three to begin with, but I had to struggle because there's plenty more.
So, yeah, if he's potentially, or as you say, you know, the smartest person ever that we know of, it doesn't seem he's as much of a household name as someone like Stephen Hawking or Einstein's maybe a better example. Yeah, why do you think he's not such a household name?
This is a really interesting question, because obviously who makes it in the media is quite different from, you know, what contributions they might have made. So, well, von Neumann didn't have funny hair, which would have helped. I think he tended to work behind the scenes quite a lot. So he had massive influence in the US government. Very famously, although rather unfairly, he became caricatured as Dr. Strangelove. So when Stanley Kubrick made Dr. Strangelove, von Neumann was one of the people that inspired Dr. Strangelove. And that came about because immediately after the Second World War, von Neumann was convinced that the Soviet Union under Stalin would start a nuclear attack. And as a result of that, he was trying to convince anybody he spoke to, I think, for several years, that the US should grasp the opportunity now before the Soviet Union had enough bombs to retaliate. And they should launch a preemptive strike if the Soviet Union didn't give up all ambition to become a nuclear power. Now, as soon as the Soviet Union, and as soon as it became clear that the Soviet Union, you know, did have an arsenal with which to strike back, von Neumann changed his mind. And what I point out in the book was that, although, you know, obviously he was wrong, and obviously this was a kind of a dreadful thought experiment, if you like, on his behalf. He wasn't alone by any means to think that this was the way to go. In fact, a large proportion of the American public thought so. Quite a few figures in government thought so, thankfully not the president at the time, and people like Bertrand Russell, who's renowned as a pacifist somehow, you know, he also suggested that essentially if the Soviet Union didn't give up its nuclear ambitions and nuclear technology was handed over to some sort of global government, he also thought that the Americans should threaten them with essentially, you know, nuclear annihilation. To understand this, I think you need to go into von Neumann's past quite deeply and look at the sort of person that he was to find out. So I think that certainly played a role. So as a result of this, you know, there's been little, I think, interest in him in academic circles, for example, beyond the maths. He's not celebrated in the way he kind of should be. And then I think there's also an aspect of von Neumann's work, which is why the book's called The Man from the Future, is that we're only now beginning to see just how influential he really was. And the last chapter of the book is actually dedicated to his theory of self-reproducing automata. So he proves mathematically that machines can reproduce, right? And what had been for centuries a philosophical question became a rigorously defined and answered question. And he did that, I think, in the late 40s. And we're still getting to grips with that now. And we're at the beginning of producing such machines in a way. I mean, just as I was finishing off the book, there were reports of these new kind of stem cell robots, and they were kind of programmed with AI, and they sort of spin round in a Petri dish and they gather together other clumps of stem cells. And then, hey presto, these stem cells also start spinning round and producing more clumps of cells and so on. And I looked at that and I thought, oh my God, this is von Neumann's theory of self-reproducing automata come to life. And I think as this century progresses, I think this aspect of von Neumann's work is going to be mentioned again and again, along with some of his early contributions to thinking about computers in the brain, which obviously led to artificial intelligence.
Do you think you'd have any particularly interesting insights on any like global events happening today that he wasn't able to write about back then? What do you think he'd think about? Any wars happening, any certain technology out at the moment?
Bear in mind that he thought that probably by the end of the 50s, if not earlier, we'd have all been wiped out by a nuclear attack. So I think the first thing is he'd be astonished that we were still here in the first place. And I would like to hope that he would have rethought a little bit, because he had a rather dire view of human nature towards the end of his life, after the Second World War, because of course he was Jewish, and he'd witnessed two things. One was that in the aftermath of the First World War, Hungary experienced a sort of communist revolution, and there was a very short-lived communist government, and that didn't go well at all, and it was pretty brutal. But immediately afterwards, there was a sort of counter-revolution by kind of conservative forces led by a general. And that was even more brutal, right? And then he was very lucky and also foresighted. He was, by the 30s, in the late 20s, early 30s, he was already writing to friends predicting there would be a Second World War, predicting that Germany would start it, and that there would be a slaughter of Jews. And in 1930, he was offered a job by Princeton, and he left Europe, and he never came back, right? And the Nazis, more than anything, completely... I think they almost destroyed any faith that he had in human nature. Now, bear in mind that before this, as he was growing up, he was born into a pretty wealthy family. And throughout his life, actually, he was known as a bit of a party animal. He liked, he liked to drink. He often worked to very loud music, often German marching music. And he was kind of, he told dirty limericks at parties. And if you sort of drill down to his actual human interactions with people, barely anybody has a bad thing to say about him. He was surprisingly, perhaps, considerate, and when he saw people floundering, when he saw other academics floundering, he would help them out. There's an example that I give in the book where he comes across Mandelbrot's work, and he's very excited by this, and he in fact gets Mandelbrot over to the Institute for Advanced Study and on a fellowship. And then Mandelbrot goes away, and years later, after von Neumann's passed away, Mandelbrot starts looking for another job, because he's fallen out with his manager in America, and he needs to look around. And he finds, when he starts writing letters, that von Neumann had actually written to key people within the field and said, Mandelbrot is doing something really exciting, but quite risky. And he could run into trouble. And if he does, help him out. And that was just one sort of example of the many instances where von Neumann helps people out. So I think, you know, there's this rather complicated picture of his personality, and the media doesn't like complexity. I think that's the other thing. Mm-hmm. And I guess the final reason, you know, if you read the book, you'll see that von Neumann's contributions were just so diverse that, you know, it ranged from quantum mechanics to the atom bomb to theory of automata to the computer to the foundations of mathematics to game theory. And everywhere he goes, he plants a seed. And I just don't think, you know, we've been able to draw those kind of disparate parts of his work together in a kind of meaningful way. But I think, you know, people are beginning to see that. I mean, there's Benjamin Labatut's new novel, The Maniac, which also has von Neumann as a key figure. So perhaps, you know, more than 70 years after he's dead, you know, it's finally going to be von Neumann's year or decade.
Yeah, so perhaps if he'd actually just focused on a few areas, he'd maybe be more famous. There was too many to know what to kind of assign to him as this is what he did.
Yeah, I think that's true. And people used to criticize him because they said if only he'd stuck to pure maths, he would have been as great as Gauss or something like that. Well, that ignores two things. Gauss didn't stick to just pure maths, quite obviously. But secondly, I think the mathematicians at the time didn't appreciate what he'd done. Some of the people at the Institute for Advanced Study were extremely dismissive of the idea that a computer could possibly be useful for maths at all. And the idea of these horrible, you know, engineers coming in and disrupting their, you know, thinking time at the blackboard, that was beyond the pale. So I think that many people were not particularly far-sighted about what he was achieving. And I think, as I said, we are beginning to appreciate that now.
So why have you personally been so fascinated by him? And again, as opposed to maybe some of these other kind of rival figures?
Well, I mean, I wasn't going to write another Einstein book, that was for sure. I think, funnily enough, my next book is kind of, it's called Relativities, or at least that's what... that is the working title. So there is a bit of Einstein in it. But what brought me to him was that I was working at The Economist. And I had a few book ideas in mind. But when you're at The Economist as a science correspondent, you bump into, obviously, economists. You bump into people who are reporting on business stories, on politics and technology. And in almost every field that we were reporting on, like, you know, the economists were talking about some Nobel Prize winner who won because of game theory, some contributions to game theory. In technology, it was AI, and everybody's excited about AI. And some of the early thoughts and early work, von Neumann would come up. And I began to think, well, surely there must be a book about this guy, about what he did. And there was a biography by Norman McRae written, I think, 20, 30 years earlier. And McRae was a World War II fighter pilot. He was also an economist editor, and he was an economist. But what he wasn't was any kind of scientist at all. So I read the biography and I thought, well, you know, this is great on the personal details, because McRae had been able to interview people who knew von Neumann. But when it got to the science, he just, you know, essentially pretty much gave up. And that book was 30 years old, and the flowering of von Neumann's contributions hadn't really taken place in the way that it has today. So I thought, there's somebody's got to do this. And I was really surprised that nobody had. And then I started researching it and I realized why nobody had. It's because those contributions are so diverse and difficult that there's an extraordinary amount to get your head around. And when I spoke to mathematicians afterwards, they were like, I complained that this had taken up over 2 years of my life. It's about 2.5 years. And I was like, I had no maths background. It was a suicide mission, really. I don't really know how this book was ever finished. And they were like, I don't know either. Because nobody's expert in all of the different fields that von Neumann was. So I mean, that's a rather long story. And I mean, when I was exploring this, I remember going home one evening and just pulling about a dozen books off a shelf full of popular science books. And I found von Neumann's name in the index of about half of them. And they ranged from neuroscience, from consciousness, to economics, through to kind of Penrose's Emperor's New Mind or whatever. And von Neumann's name just kept popping up in the index. And he'd just appear for a page or two. Oh, he's in Jacob Bronowski's Ascent of Man as well, quite famously, because Bronowski spent some time with him in a taxi and was completely awed by von Neumann. This is incredible that he just pops up at these key times in a kind of radically decisive, I think, moment of history, that early to mid 20th century. You know, but if you think about what happened during those years from about 1900 to 1945, it was an incredible time of change. You know, we didn't have computers and then we did. You know, we didn't have atom bombs and hydrogen bombs and then we did. And here was a guy that was involved with every single one of those moments of technology and science. And so it seemed like this was a book that was just crying out to be written.
Yeah, and you said, talking about his personality, he bit of a joker, quite a, liked to drink, quite a kind of fun guy. He wasn't much of a kind of, unless this is a bit of a kind of stereotype and trope, wasn't really much of a tortured genius, or he was quite a happy person.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, because when we think about what happened towards the end of his life, was he quite as happy as we imagine? Now, what I discovered when I was writing the book was that he was almost certainly, we didn't have these terms at the time, but he was probably, if he was around now, he'd be diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, which weirdly does not come up, but it's so clear from his second wife's journal that this is what was going on. I mean, she cites the fact that he couldn't go into a room without flipping a light switch on and off 5 times, that when he went past a tall building, he'd have to touch it with his elbow. And there are all these instances in her journals that suggest this.
His second wife.
So his first wife actually divorced him because Marriott was a very clever herself, another Jewish Hungarian, and she went off to become this incredible manager of scientific projects, and she set up, I think it was the Brookhaven Laboratory on Long Island, if I have that right. I may not have that right, but it was a big lab. And she was kind of the chief administrator for that, because she had so many contacts and she was just very fast. But she left von Neumann because she was tired of playing second fiddle to his brain. So she ended up marrying a postdoc who was hanging around, I think, Princeton or somewhere like that. So his second wife was Clara Dan, another wealthy Jewish Hungarian. And she ends up becoming the first modern computer programmer. But in her journal, she keeps rather rich notes of the people that she meets. Very little about herself, sadly, but quite a lot about the people that she was moving around with. And she mentions these sorts of episodes in there.
Do you think you've changed at all by learning so much about him? Has he had any influence on you yourself?
Let's start with, you know, what is the effect of delving into the work and to some degree the life? It's mostly about the work, but you get this impression of a brain that's impossibly fast, right? A brain that was faster than anybody's, right? And I mean that because he would go to, you know, he would hang around at Los Alamos, and there was Enrico Fermi, there was about half a dozen Nobel Prize winners and future Nobel Prize winners there. And there were famous incidents, like every time von Neumann turned up, Fermi would sort of challenge him to solving some deep mathematical physics problem on the blackboard. And every single time, according to Fermi, von Neumann won. In terms of what writing the book, that experience, well, I'd always wanted to write a book, right? So from about the age of five, for as long as I can remember, I thought it would be a novel, but it's one of those geeky kids who sat around at the age of six or seven writing poetry and reading comics and lots of books and things like that. And science only really came along a bit later. I was interested in physics, and that's what I ended up doing at university. But I think stories were extraordinarily important in writing and creative writing. So, you know, I thought when I was doing my PhD and writing would be just something that I fitted in along with everything else that I was doing. And I realized at a certain stage that that wasn't going to happen. And if I wanted to write, then I would just have to make the change, because I'm not, you know, time management in that sense is not something that I ever really was particularly adept at. And the idea after spending a day in the lab of coming home and settling down to write was just, it just wasn't going to happen. So when I had my professorship or something, and then perhaps I could have settled down to think about writing, but that would have been far too late for me, I think. So it was, so clearly this was something that I'd always wanted to do. And the moments of writing that book when I sat down to do it were bliss. Now, bear in mind that at least half the book was written during lockdown, when we were also homeschooling. My wife's an academic, and she was asked within 4 days, I think, or 5 days, to put her entire teaching online. Mm-hmm. Meantime, the schools and the nurseries all just closed down. And suddenly, you know, I was trying to do something that I had no desire to ever do, which was to homeschool. Mm-hmm. And this was terrible. I don't think my son would see it any differently. He was, it was just a dreadful time. And the issue there was that he wasn't seeing other children. Mm. And I think we recognize now that taking children out of school in this way is probably the worst thing you can do, both for them, for society, for parents. Mm. And I doubt very much that we will ever do that again. So so you learn a lot about yourself during that experience. But writing was kind of a sort of safe haven when I got time to do it for a few hours. And it's kind of a relief to know that, because for years and years I'd said, if only I had time to write, you know, how happy I would be, you know. And it was true. It was great. It was very, very tough. And there were phone call after phone call when I was trying to iron out some bit of the science that I didn't understand. But it was also extremely enjoyable. I also found out that writing a clever book does not make you a lot of money. So, you know, if you want to make a lot of make a lot of money, then don't write a clever book. Mm. Write a self-help book. They always sell very well. Mm. So there's lots of life lessons in there.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. And could you tell us a little bit about what you get up to at the moment with your job, and also how you like to spend your time outside of work? What do you get up to for fun and for leisure?
Yeah, having two young kids, leisure is relatively limited. In between lugging around a double bass and a cello for music lessons at the same time, if you've seen the size of even a junior, a half-size double bass, then you'll know what I mean. So I was sort of 5 years self-employed as a writer. So 2.5 years of those was writing the book. And then there was a lot of time spent after that promoting the book. In fact, here I am, I'm still doing it. Because the US edition came out 6 months later. And there was all sorts of stuff to resolve. The Americans are crazy on picture rights, so you had to sort that out. And then I went on
this. What was that exactly? What do you have to sort out?
Well, you have to make sure that wherever you've got the picture from, the Americans insist on finding the right owner, contacting them, and getting to sign it off. And so we had to drop a lot of pictures that was perfectly acceptable to European publishers, but wasn't acceptable in the US because they're much more, people are much more likely to sue in the US. Mm. So this was a lot of work, and I was rather dull. And, but then, you know, there were talks to give mostly online at this stage, but there were some, went to a couple of book festivals. And then finally, almost a year later, back in over a year later, last year, I was invited to go to India for a couple, a week and a half to give book talks and go on book tour there. That was the other side. There was the promotion. And then, because I'm a dreadfully practical person, I spent a year writing a children's science fiction novel, which is kind of going backwards and forwards now between me and my agent. So I'm currently in the middle of rewriting that. So maybe that will be another project. But that took me, again, there's no quick wins in my life. That took almost a year, I think, for me to write. And now I'm kind of editing it. But so there was that. So that was kind of 5 years. And obviously there was some freelancing, I did a couple of book reviews and so on. And now I work for the London Institute for Mathematical Sciences, which came about fairly recently. I think I've been there for 2.5 weeks. And that's great fun. So I'm their chief science writer. And it's the sort of job that I was looking for, because I think there's a role both in like tech firms and in academic institutes and universities for somebody in those sciences like physics and maths to act as a kind of go-between. And in tech firms, that could be as a go-between between the, you know, the tech guys, the programmers, the people who are thinking deeply about the technology, and then there's people from, say, the marketing side, from admin side, who know nothing really about the technology. And then, you know, that communication can lead to innovation. And I think LIMS also sees it that way. And what that amounts to is, for example, I might sit down with a mathematician and go, well, you know, I don't understand your paper, right? But I could. Why don't you tell me what this paper is supposed to be about? And that act of explaining and asking stupid questions makes them kind of focus their question a little bit more. And when it comes to writing the paper, or rewriting the paper, that has an impact. Because a lot of papers just simply aren't read. Mm. The idea is that if you make something more intelligible, just a little bit more intelligible, people are more likely to pick it up. Even other mathematicians are more likely to pick it up. And if people pick it up, it's more likely to be cited. And because if work isn't seen, then it's certainly not going to be cited. If people read the first two sentences of your paper and just switch off, then it's unlikely to make a difference. So that's part of it. And then there's various communication aspects and so on. So if there's a big, if they have a big paper, I might write a little news story or a summary of it. And that there's the scope to think about kind of broader features and stories that come out of that work, but might just be a hot topic more widely. And so it's just a great place to be embedded, because as a kind of writer, because you're assailed by cutting edge maths and theoretical physics, right? So you can have these conversations just every day, and from there there's you know, there's a constant wellspring in theory of stories. So it's a very stimulating environment to be in.
As a final question, I've started asking in the last few episodes, actually, everyone just the same last question, just trying to build up a picture of what different people from different fields think. The question is, what does it mean to live a good life? What would you say to that?
Yeah, the less I think about that, the better. I spent a lot of time on this. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said that an unhealthy interest in ethics, or a deep interest in ethics, is a sign of a stunted intellect. All right, and when I was in my as a typical Wilde, but when I was sort of in my early 20s, I spent a great deal of time kind of reading kind of about moral philosophy and, you know, a bit of Spinoza, Plato, and so on, to try and figure things out. I didn't come up with any, you know, particularly deep answers to that. I think you kind of have to live your life. I kind of feel that you try and find your niche, try and contribute. Most of us have to work if we're not lucky enough to be born into wealth. So find something that you enjoy doing, because that's how you're going to be spending the majority of your time on this planet. You know, be nice to people, keep your brain engaged, because if you let it freewheel for too long, then you can go to dark places. So I have no answers, which is why I'm not writing a self-help book. But I do believe that writing that self-help book or reading that self-help book isn't going to help anybody. I think you have to come to your own answers yourself. And the only way you do that is by living life with, as Plato said, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living. So, you know, think about your own life, draw the lessons that you can from it, read widely. And that's, you know, those are my top tips for living well, I think.
Well, thanks a lot for this great book. As I said, recommend people read it, and thanks for your time today. It's great to chat.
Thanks very much, Joe.
Thanks a lot.
It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you enjoy The Human Podcast, please consider subscribing. I hope to see you soon.